Amy works for me. And Amy comes to me and says, Tony, I got a problem. If Amy's a relator, I handle her one way. If Amy is a director, I handle her a different way. Would you agree? If Amy's a relator, I have to handle her friendly. A thinker, precisely. A director, rapidly, efficiently. A socializer, dynamically, fun. All right, so let's make believe Amy is a relator. And Amy, you don't have to say or do anything, okay? But she is a relator. You are a relator? All right, as a relator. Now, I want you to listen to three things. Early on, I told you, when it comes to listening, what are the three channels you listen for? The three V's. Verbal, vocal, visual. Watch how I will vary all three in dealing with Amy. First as a relator, then a thinker, then a director, then a socializer. Watch. She's a relator. She comes to me as one of my employees and says, Tony, I have a problem. I sit down. She's sitting. I'm sitting. All right? I'm at the same level. And by the way, because she's a relator, I can get physically closer. Okay? So I say, Amy, share with me what the problem is. All right? Relators love the word share. All right? So share with me what the problem is. And what I suggest we do is we put our heads together and see if we can come up with a comfortable, realistic way to deal with it. And Amy, I want you to know that once we implement a solution, I'm by your side every step of the way. If there's other questions or problems or concerns, I want you to know that I'm there for you, okay?
Oh, that's nice to hear.
Okay? All right? The directors are saying, get out of here with this! Am I right? The directors are going crazy with this! Now, if Amy's a thinker, I have to treat her very differently, right? If Amy's a thinker, I have to treat her precisely. So Amy comes to me as a thinker and says, Tony, I got a problem. I say, Amy, tell me in detail what the problem is, and if there are subparts, prioritize them. Let you generate all relevant alternatives, analyze them, choose the obvious best one. Then we'll set up a timetable to monitor and measure how well it's working. Set corrective action if necessary.
That's why I'm coming here for that problem.
Neither of those first two approaches would work with a director or a socializer, would they? All right, Amy's a director. How do I treat her? Fast, to the point. Get in and out. All right. Now, if Amy were a real director, she'd probably come to me and say, Tony, you got a problem. But let's just say that Amy comes to me as a director and says, Tony, I got a problem. Watch this. Watch how fast it is. It's like this. Amy, what's the problem? What do you think we should do about it? That's it.
Yeah, the 1 minute
manager. It's like the 1 second manager. Amy's a socializer. She comes to me, says, Tony, I got a problem. I say, Amy, hey, Amy, we all got problems. Let's do lunch.
That's adaptability. To be willing and able to bend a bit if that's what it takes to make a relationship better. Adaptability is a way to work more effectively with people in all kinds of situations. It means thinking before you act. It means not just doing or saying the first thing that comes to your mind. The truth is, you do it all the time. You probably show a different side of yourself when you go to the boss's house for dinner than when you go to a friend's place for a game of cards. You likely act differently at a ball game than you do at a business meeting. And do you behave the same at an art museum as you do at a Halloween party? Of course not. You adapt because you sense that a different type of behavior is called for if you're to be successful and to be accepted. And you're right. Here's the key point. You can sharpen that skill of knowing when and how to adapt. You can learn to adapt to all kinds of people and situations. And as a result, you can find success and acceptance that you've never dreamed of. Every savvy business person knows that if you're trying to conduct business in a foreign country, you must learn to understand and respect certain cultural differences. Let's say that you're heading to Japan. Perhaps you learn the correct way to bow, or to eat with chopsticks, or negotiate in the more low-key, accommodating style. Why? Because it's respectful and it's important. It's also respectful and important to learn to adapt to the personal styles of others in your own workplace. More than you realize, your happiness, your effectiveness, and your future will all be affected by how well you get along with other people. And how well you get along depends in large measure on your ability to adapt. The truly adaptable person meets the other person's needs as well as his own. Through my research, I found that while most people are not as adaptable as they think, they can learn better adaptability. This segment of the program will show you how and when to adapt your style to connect with anyone. Many of us do this instinctively when we talk a little bit more with chatty people or are a bit more quiet with deep thinkers. But you're going to learn how to systematically operate within the other person's comfort zone. Adaptability doesn't mean mimicking another person's style. It doesn't mean abandoning your own identity or your good business sense. It just means adjusting your openness and your directness to make relationships work. Even as you alter your own style to better mesh with others, it's important to maintain your own identity. Someone who's too adaptable can be seen as wishy-washy or insincere. So this program will help you modify your spots, not change them. Relationships are like money in a way. They must be managed. Through attention and practice, you can learn to do just that. You can see when no change is called for and when a modest compromise is appropriate, or even when the situation calls for a fairly radical adjustment to another person's behavioral style. Learn the skill of adaptability, and you'll learn how to handle relationships in a way that allows everyone to win. Learn that skill, and you'll learn to make everyone more comfortable. Learn that skill, and you'll truly be practicing the Platinum Rule. No one style is naturally more adaptable than another, and the adjustments will vary for each of us. That's because adaptability is something you choose. You can choose to be quite adaptable with one person today and less adaptable with that same individual tomorrow. You can choose to be adaptable in one situation and unadaptable in another. But to have that option, you first need to learn the skill of adaptability. So for starters, whatever your style, let's discuss some simple actions that you can take to improve that skill. Here's a quick checklist on expanding adaptability for each behavioral style. If you're a relater, you can say no occasionally. Take some risks. Delegate to others. Accept logical changes. Verbalize your feelings to appropriate people. And finish tasks without oversensitivity to others' feelings. Socializers can control time and emotions. Try to be more objective. Follow up on promises and tasks. Concentrate on the job at hand. Try a more logical approach. And spend more time checking, specifying, and organizing. Thinkers can openly show concern and appreciation of others. Initiate new projects. Use policies as guidelines, not laws. Collaborate by seeking common ground. Occasionally try shortcuts and time savers, and make timely decisions. And directors can project a more relaxed image by pacing themselves, become more open, patient listeners, develop sensitivity and empathy, genuinely compliment others, act less hastily and more cautiously, and identify with the group rather than being a lone ranger. Okay. So those are some of the things that you can do unilaterally to make your style more compatible with the world at large. But how do you adapt to specific people in specific situations? Let's listen to a pair of directors tell us how to do that.
When you're working with me, please don't waste my time. Before you see or call me, know exactly what you're going to say and give it to me as quickly as you can. If we have an appointment, don't be late. I've got a lot of things to do.
If you give me some information about a project, just tell me what is absolutely necessary for me to either be productive or make a decision. I don't want to know the reasons behind everything. I'm like a general in my command post. I leave all the small details for the lieutenants.
Appeal to my common sense, not my emotions. If there are real practical benefits to what you say, I won't mind taking risks or making tough decisions, but I'll want to see the numbers first. I always want to know the upside and downside potential before I put my reputation on the line.
Some people make the mistake of complimenting me on my clothes, my jewelry, or the way I look. That doesn't work with me. Compliment me on something specific, like one of my recent accomplishments. Those are the things I really care about.
I definitely live life in the fast lane. I don't dilly-dally when there are decisions to make.
I delegate a lot, and then personally hold people accountable. I expect competence in everyone around me, and I have no patience for wishy-washy people or those who overpromise and under-deliver.
Let's listen to some advice from a pair of socializers.
If you want to put me at ease, be informal, relax, let your hair down, get to know me. I don't like to be rushed into business conversations, you know? I'd rather break the ice first with friendly small talk.
I really like people, and I hit it off best with people who make it clear that they like me. I love people who are bubbly and enthusiastic, people who are upbeat and fun.
I like to look at the big picture, and I'm a dreamer with a vivid imagination. When people try to sell something to me, I want them to hit me where I live, show me how to achieve my dreams.
I like variety. I get bored easily, so I appreciate it when my supervisor gives me a lot of different short-term projects to work on, rather than long, repetitive, or complex ones.
What keeps me happy at work is interacting with people. I'm usually the one who gets the accounts where people need some softening up before we can even discuss business.
He's the same way at home. We're both happier on the weekends when we have something to get out and do. A short getaway, a party. Anything's better than sitting at home.
Yeah, that's why they call us Mr. and Mrs. Whirlwind. We never stop.
Okay, now we've gotten tips from directors and from socializers. What about relators?
I want to be appreciated for the things I do. I'm not expecting an award ceremony or a call from the president, but it's nice to get an occasional pat on the back for my contribution. Positive strokes keep me going.
One way to get along with me better is to be real. Spend time getting to know me. I value trust and rapport. I'm the type of person who does not have a large number of friends, but the ones I do have are quality, lifelong friends. Some of my business associates are my friends.
I give a lot to people, so I feel that people should be willing to give in return. I try to weed out the takers from the givers. And my real friends are like me, givers.
I realize that I work slowly and methodically. If you have a faster way for me to accomplish something, I'm open to what you have to say, but present it to me in a way that doesn't make me feel stupid about my approach. And explain to me why I should do it your way. Please don't just say, do it this way.
I admit that I shy away from risks. If you need me to make a decision, such as a purchase, give me all the information I need in a slow, orderly manner. And remember that I will have to present this information to other people to get their input. I also like the security the guarantees provide in reducing risks for me.
I like things to run smoothly. So I work best in stable, calm environments with people who are cooperative, relaxed, friendly, and team-oriented.
All right, let's hear from the thinkers.
I work well with people who give me the information I need when I need it. I like to make my own decisions, and to do so, I compare and contrast data from a number of sources.
In a business context, I often run across people, especially men, who compliment me for no apparent good reason. I understand this phenomenon, but I don't really need it or appreciate it. Now, don't get me wrong. I like being appropriately complimented. But when it comes to praise, I'm skeptical of empty-sounding compliments. So give me real feedback on specifics. Don't tell me I did a great job. Tell me exactly what it was that impressed you or worked well.
In business, well, actually always, I'm very punctual. As a result, I'm annoyed by people who are consistently late. I prefer people who respect my time and efforts. If you have an appointment with me, please show up on time. Usually I'm the one that's early.
I suppose I might be described as shy. I don't like being put in a social or business situation in which there are a lot of strangers. And if these situations are unavoidable, please do me the favor of introducing me to someone and helping us feel comfortable by pointing out something that you know we have in common. That way we can carry on a civilized conversation and avoid the awkwardness of, so what do you think about this weather?
You might want to listen to those pairs of people several more times in order to really get a feel for how you can adapt your behavior in each case. Now I want to give you several examples of adaptability in action. Let's say it's Deirdre's first day on the job as co-manager of marketing. She'll be working with Henry, who's been the sole manager up until now. Deirdre's a relator. She and Henry have only met a couple of times previously, so she doesn't know him very well. She walks into Henry's office through an open door, smiles, and extends her hand.
Hello, Henry. It's nice to see you again. I'm looking forward to working with you.
Hello. Didn't my secretary tell you I've got a meeting in a few minutes? If you'll wait outside, I'll see you in an hour or so. Didn't my secretary tell you that people schedule appointments with me? I'm busy most of this week. Maybe we can talk sometime next week.
Deirdre, being a student of the Platinum Rule, can see right away that Henry is no relator. He's fast-paced and task-oriented rather than people-oriented. There are probably two main ways she might respond. Her natural response, which we'll call Deirdre number one, might be,
Gee, Henry, I'm sorry to have interrupted. Forgive me. Sure, I'll talk with your secretary and see if we can set something up in a week or two when your schedule is more clear.
Or perhaps Deirdre could come up with another response. Let's call that Deirdre number two.
Well, I don't want to interrupt your work, but we do have some business we've got to get to soon. Others are depending on us. Have you given any thought about a plan for how we can work on the transition to a co-managership? If you have anything for me to read or do on it, I'll begin right now.
Which scenario shows the most adaptability? You might see Deirdre number one as being most adaptable. She actually agreed to do what Henry wanted, whether reasonable or not. But that's not really what's meant by adaptability. If she'd done that, she would have been acquiescent, as a relator naturally tends to do. Instead, Deirdre number two, sensing her normal style wouldn't suffice, modified her behavior to better communicate with fast-paced, task-oriented Henry. She spoke up with a strong yet positive response. She became more fast-paced and task-oriented herself. Deirdre number two confidently expressed how her own interest would affect both of them and their business at hand. I'm sure she'll gain Henry's attention and cooperation much faster that way. So adapting doesn't mean wimping out or giving in or rolling over. It does mean recognizing whether the other person is fast-paced or slow-paced, task-oriented or people-oriented, and then moving in that direction. Deirdre had only a few moments to scope out Henry's characteristics and adapt to them. But let's say that she and Henry do start working together often, and she gets more of a chance to observe his personal style. If she's to succeed in her new job, adapting to Henry is going to be an ongoing, important challenge. So she wants to take adaptability a step further. As she goes into the first few meetings with him, she looks for other signs. She notices that Henry sits behind his desk rather than on the couch or at the small table in his office where they might be closer. Usually, after a glance at his watch, he begins the meeting. And after a few months of working together, Henry springs this speech on her.
Frankly, Deirdre, you're not ready for this job. I've seen nice young people like you promoted over their heads before. It won't work. It always ends badly. You ought to go talk to that bonehead who gave you this promotion and see if there aren't any other alternatives for you. In short, I don't need you here. You won't like it, and in the long run you'll hurt yourself by being here because there's nothing for you to do. And even if there were, you and I would be like oil and water. That's blunt. I know. But I believe in speaking plainly, and so I'm telling you this for your own good.
Deirdre listens, trying to keep her anger under control and quickly figure out her best response. Henry is very direct, assertive, aggressive, confrontational. He's not at all shy about exerting control. He's also guarded rather than open. He's task-oriented, disciplined about time, somewhat formal and proper. Though he's told her that she'll never fit in, he hasn't shared any personal feelings about his work, the company, or her. Henry, Deirdre realizes, is direct and guarded. A director. Deirdre mulls over her options quickly, and her instinctual response as a relator would be,
That's interesting. Perhaps you're right. I do want the job, but on the other hand, we've certainly got to get along if this co-manager relationship is going to work. And I appreciate your words about my long-term future here. Let me think about what you've said, and I'll get back to you.
Now, Deirdre knows that won't do. Henry would just steamroll over her like he's probably done to so many others. Instead, she needs to get on his wavelength by becoming more direct and less open. So she might say,
"Let me remind you, Henry, that it was headquarters that assigned me to this job. Obviously, somebody upstairs believes I have something to offer and that you do need help managing the department. Frankly, if they thought you were doing such a terrific job already, they wouldn't have sent me. Therefore, I expect your cooperation. I want this to work, and I'm doing my best to make that happen. However, if you don't want to play ball, I'll have no choice but to tell the vice president that you're being resistant. And that won't be good for you or your career, Henry. Not good at all."
That would be very direct, but overly controlling. That would be like talking to him like a director, all right. And it might mean the end of any opportunity for genuine cooperation between Henry and Deirdre. Out-Henrying Henry would probably be the death knell to any hopes of effectively co-managing the department. So wisely, Deirdre opts for a third approach, like this.
"I understand your concern, Henry, because I know how committed you are to the success of our department. If I were you, I also might be worried about whether I was turning my baby over to someone who maybe wasn't quite ready to assume such responsibility. But let's face it, Henry, I wouldn't be here unless other people several levels above us thought I was ready. So I have an obligation to justify their confidence in me. I want to do that by learning as much as I can from you. You've got the experience, and I want to work with you. I want to help sustain the progress that you've made in the years you've been here. And you're right, sure, we're different. But think of the synergy the two of us can create. We can make marketing a standout that'll be the envy of every other department in this firm."
What did Deirdre do in this last response? She modified her openness and directness to be more in line with Henry's. She decreased her openness by being more businesslike, having more of a logical, factual orientation. She increased her directness by speaking at a faster pace, giving a recommendation rather than asking for an opinion, facing conflict head-on, using direct statements rather than posing questions, and challenging him tactfully. Deirdre also showed empathy for Henry that was missing in the earlier responses. If you were Henry, wouldn't you be more inclined to work with Deirdre number 3? Absolutely. Both gained by Deirdre's ability and willingness to modify her style. Deirdre finally got some cooperation. And Henry could at least see the potential in working with this savvy woman who wouldn't be pushed around and who understood and appreciated him. So the Henry-Deirdre relationship was transformed from the brink of a bitter clash into what's potentially a lasting win-win situation. But just think, if Henry had also practiced the Platinum Rule, he would have figured out that Deirdre was a relator. Can you imagine how much less friction there would have been? How much more quickly they could have come to terms if Henry also had been willing to adapt? Here's another example. Tom is an up-and-coming young manager at a growing electronics firm. He's also a thinker, so he prides himself on attention to detail, thoroughness, and following procedures. And he's committed to a career at this company, which really puts a high priority on employee morale. But Tom isn't thrilled when his department head asks him to spearhead plans for a company-wide picnic. Previously, each department had its own picnic. But now the firm's president, trying to encourage cohesiveness, wants everybody to picnic together. And as a further effort at cohesiveness, Tom has assigned a co-chair for the project, Joel, who's in the sales department. And even though Tom prefers to work alone, he decides to make the best of the situation. So he goes looking for Joel in his office. Tom sees that Joel's desk is cluttered and disorganized. Numerous plaques and certificates cover the walls. a small straw sombrero, souvenir of some Mexican junket, sits cockeyed atop a bowling trophy. Behind it, there's a picture of Joel performing at a karaoke bar. Tom, who's naturally much more understated and reserved, feels his stomach tighten. Joel is talking animatedly on the telephone, but he waves Tom on in.
So I say to him, listen, I'm in this for the long run. Oh, come on in, Tom. Excuse me, my next meeting that I didn't know I had just walked in. Oh my God, is it 2:15 already? Anyway, to make a long story somewhat sufferable, I say to him, I'm in it for the long run. And if you're not, then we have nothing else to talk about. Suffice it to say, he took the bait. I mean, I wasn't going to walk. I can't afford to walk, but he didn't know that. So everything's back to honky-dory, at least for a week or two. Anyway, I got to go. This guy is waiting here. So I'll talk to you tomorrow or Monday, whenever. Give me a call when you find out more and know what the order's going to look like. And tell Brucey hello for me. Yeah, you got it. So long. Oh, sorry, Tom. I've been juggling 18 things here this week. Plus, the kids just came back from camp, so everything's turned upside down at home. Hey, do you have kids?
Yes. Two. A boy and a girl.
Oh, yeah. Now I remember. So you know exactly how it feels. So I'm running out to grab some lunch. What can I do for you?
I just stopped by to talk about the picnic.
Oh, yeah. They put you and me on it. Right. That should be a lot of fun. So have you had lunch?
Yes. Ate a while ago. Listen, Joel, I'd like to set down a preliminary task list. Maybe a tentative timeline, just to determine which of us will be doing what
in the next... Tom! That's still 6 weeks away. Besides, no big deal, right? I mean, we got some burgers and buns and balloons for the kids and... Bingo! We got it handled. It's no biggie.
Now Tom's really concerned. Here's the guy he's counting on to help put this thing together, and Joel's acting supremely relaxed, almost as if he can't be bothered. But Tom knows it's little things like picnics that affect how you're viewed by the managers, and that a screw-up here, when the big boss is watching, could have a longer-term consequence for both of them. Joel just doesn't realize the importance of the assignment. With only 6 weeks remaining, Tom thinks... They've got to nail down a site, get the food ordered, arrange entertainment, and a host of other things. In fact, they should have a schedule already drawn up with deadlines and responsibilities attached. As a thinker, Tom's natural response to the Joel conflict would most likely be to withdraw. He'd be tempted to just write Joel off as a lightweight and say to himself,
If he's such a hopeless bumbler that he won't jump in and help me get this thing handled, then I'll just have to do it myself. In fact, I'll probably be better off.
That would be his natural internal response as a thinker. And his natural external response would be this.
Sure, Joel, that sounds fine. I'll just look into a few things, but why don't you give me a call as we get closer to the date?
But Tom remembers the platinum rule. He knows that Joel is open, he's already told Tom his life story, and direct, he was quick to sound off on just about everything, including how picnics ought to be spontaneous, not planned. Open and direct? Right. So he's a socializer, the type that Tom often has the most trouble with. Tom doesn't want to blow this by getting uptight and walking away without a promise of cooperation, so he decides to adjust his response. Tom will speed up his pace, act a little looser, show an interest in Joel as well as in getting the job done, and show that he's concerned with people as well as tasks.
Maybe you're right, Joel. This assignment isn't going to become the highlight of your resume or mine. But you gotta do what you gotta do, I guess. But I can tell that you're a people person. And our mission, if we choose to accept it, is to put on a picnic where everyone will have a good time. Morale will be improved and so on. Plus, did you know the company president is the one who came up with this idea? It's probably not the job you or I would have picked for ourselves, but I suspect the big guy's going to be watching. How about this for an idea? Let me make a few phone calls about the availability of a site, and get an estimate of how much and what kind of food we're going to need. Maybe you could do some noodling about games and activities. Then we'll compare notes in, what, a week or so?
What did Tom do? He avoided confrontation. He tried to be more sociable. He sent out signals that he appreciates Joel as a person and that even though they have differing priorities, they could work together and maybe help themselves in the eyes of top management. Tom still isn't sure how much of a help Joel's going to be, especially on follow-through. But at least Tom hasn't burned any bridges. He's kept open the possibility of turning the picnic project into a mutual win instead of a hopeless clash of styles. And at their next meeting, Tom may be able to take the relationship a step further. Tom correctly saw what he had to do to avoid alienating Joel. He didn't abandon his principles. He didn't change his personality. But because there was so much at stake, he did make some temporary changes in his approach. Now, if Joel had also been adhering to the Platinum Rule, he could have helped by moving a bit toward Tom's position. He could have seen that Tom was indirect and guarded, a thinker. Then he could have altered his own style. He could have talked less, listened more, and focused on the facts. That would have practically ensured that the picnic would be a well-planned, well-run, fun-filled affair, as well as a feather in both their caps. Actually, differences in style can bring a zest to problem-solving. The whole can be more than the sum of the parts. Often, stylistic differences, if they can be bridged, will lend an energy to a team effort that similar styles would not. So you see, adaptability doesn't mean imitation of the other person's style. It doesn't mean being wishy-washy or two-faced or trying to be something that you're not. Deirdre, for example, didn't try to coerce Henry. She wouldn't have felt comfortable doing so, and it probably would not have worked. Instead, she adjusted her style in a way that put her more on Henry's wavelength. Likewise, though he might have been tempted, Tom didn't spin on his heels and walk out. Nor did he cave in and agree that the picnic planning should be left to whim. He made an effort to meet Joel at least halfway. That's what adaptability and the Platinum Rule are all about. The antidote to most personality conflict is just that obvious. Cultivate a style that's adaptable. Give your full attention to the other person and seek to cooperate, not confront. Adaptability is the key to success with people. Some of us do it naturally. Others need to work at it because lifelong habits of competition, conflict, and resistance to change are not altered overnight. But it's doable if you're committed, if you use both your head and your heart.
Oh, it's interesting to watch each of the styles as a manager when they have to let somebody go, when they have to fire somebody. Of all the four styles, who will have most difficulty firing somebody? The relator, obviously. Who would find it most easy? The director. Now, here's how a relator fires somebody. What they want to do is call somebody in the office and hope that they quit. Right? So they call Chuck into the office and they say, Chuck, come on in. How you doing? How's the family? Yeah, sit down. Come on. I was just wondering, Chuck, how do you like working here and how's things been going for you? And as I'm listening to Chuck, as a relator, I'm listening to him and I'm saying, oh, really? It's going that well. Really? You like it that much? Why am I asking? No, I was just curious. Just curious. No, nothing wrong. I'll see you later. So Chuck leaves. See, the relators can't fire. So the relator calls the director in and says, call Chuck in. Right? So the director... Here's how they fire somebody. Chuck, come on in. Don't bother sitting down. Thinkers. Mr. Nelms, please come in. Sit down. In front of you, I have two sheets of paper. The left side are all of the specific goals and objectives and benchmarks that you had committed to achieve during the last 6 months. And on the right hand side, the right sheet, are all of your actual results. And I want you to know that to the very right are all the standard deviations of how poorly you performed on each of those action items. And as a result, and they kind of go in from there. Everything is by the book. Socializers. How do they let somebody go? Hey, Chucky, come on in, baby. How you doing? Hey, you're not going to believe this. I got great news for you. A new job opportunity. Not with us, but it's great.
When it comes to having to fire someone, a person's preferred behavioral style is bound to show through. It also becomes apparent in ongoing group situations. How much work time do you spend in meetings with at least two other people? If you're like many of us, you've got planning meetings, staff meetings, project meetings, budget meetings. The list seems nearly endless. No wonder one office joker described meetings as the practical alternative to work. Some estimates are that as much as 50 to 80% of a manager's time is spent with groups. Organizations love these groups. Call them teams, committees, task forces, boards, panels, whatever. And why shouldn't they? When they work, they can improve processes, help employees feel more involved, and maybe even spur innovation. But when they flop, or more commonly, just deteriorate into mediocrity, they can drain an organization of its vitality and leave a legacy of frustration. Posturing, power struggles, and misunderstandings are so common that you've probably wondered at times if more wouldn't get done if your group never met again. One of the reasons for the spotty track record of work groups is that we're generally naive about them. Too often, we assume a group can automatically be a team. We act as if we can just order a good one from purchasing, and so we opt for an off-the-rack model instead of designing a group that'll do the job best. Round up the usual suspects, the gendarme ordered in the famous line from the movie Casablanca. And frequently, that's what bosses seem to be thinking when they originate committees or task forces. They say something like, hey, we'll get a few of our best minds together and figure out this problem. Or they might say, let's appoint anyone who might know something about this issue. Or even say, grab anybody who's got a stake in this thing. But in truth, making those choices is not as simple as it sounds. And whom you choose will very likely affect the outcome. My friend and colleague, Dr. Phil Hunsaker, has found in his work on styles of executive decision-making that the key is to analyze the objective before you recruit a group and then create a team that best matches the desired results. One of the biggest single reasons why teams misfire is that behavioral differences are ignored. That can be the fault of the group's creator, the team members themselves, or both. In either event, that's where the platinum rule comes in. As we've learned, all people are not created equal, at least not so far as their behavior patterns are concerned. Knowing and taking into account those differences can enable us to make the best possible use of the strengths of each team member. Directors can do some things a whole lot better than relators, and a thinker might easily handle something that would drive a socializer nuts. If you're armed with the platinum rule, you'll be more able to assign projects to those likely to do them well, sustain a cooperative climate in which each person can gain genuine respect and recognition, and customize work groups to get the best results in the most efficient, satisfying manner. The four styles each bring different perspectives to a group, and different ways of doing things, too. So let's take a look at some of the basic characteristics of the four styles in group situations. How they communicate, influence, set goals, involve others, and make decisions. Each communicates in ways so different that it's no wonder misunderstandings occur. Directors, for example, tend to communicate with short, task-oriented comments, particularly at the start of a meeting when they like to assume control and set the meeting in motion. More than the other styles, they're concerned about having a clear agenda and setting a tone. They like to keep the discussion on track and on time. Directors usually talk the most at the beginning and end of meetings, perhaps losing interest in the middle. They also may jump into a discussion, bringing lots of energy and a sense of urgency. Then they may pull back, frustrated with the failure to make rapid, tangible progress. Before long, they begin to call attention to how much time's gone by. Soon, they're pressing for closure and for concrete decisions. Socializers, by contrast, communicate more frequently and more evenly throughout a meeting. Their comments are more likely to include jokes and to cover a range of topics so wide that the socializers may appear to be hopping all over the place. Relators seem generally interested in discussions throughout the whole meeting. They may ask many questions, trying to understand others' points of view and what follow-through will be expected. They naturally act as synthesizers, go-betweens, or translators by saying things like, "Now, if I understand what Jane and Tom meant, it's that the next step is to," or they may even say, "To get back to Samantha's comment, it seems that her idea dovetails very nicely with what Bob mentioned a few minutes ago." On the other hand, thinkers tend to quietly observe until they fully grasp an issue and have figured out in some detail what they want to say and if they'll feel comfortable saying it. They often begin by asking a few well-chosen questions. Then, if the climate seems receptive, they'll build up to a longer statement on what they believe is the answer. The different styles also try to influence the group in very different ways. This can become a critical issue because, as we'll see later in this segment, every group at an early stage wrestles with the issue of who's going to wield power. Directors like to influence others by structuring agendas, tasks, and assignments, and if relevant, use their formal position as leverage. You might hear one say, "As general manager for the past 18 years, I've seen these situations develop, and I think..." Socializers are more inclined to use flattery or compliments to win over the group and get the members to feel good as a team. They'll often use humor to diffuse tension or conflict, and they try to avoid a hard line that'll cause them to lose the acceptance or recognition of the group. Relators, whether they're anointed leaders or not, often take on the role of keeping the process moving along. They'll elaborate on what others say and encourage everyone to have their say. They seek to exert influence indirectly by keeping things mellow and moving along. Information and logic are the tools of the thinkers. They like to furnish information that, directly or indirectly, suggests their expertise and experience. A thinker might say, "Remember, I was one of those who came up with the original plan. The rationale at that time was clear, and I think what we want to do here is..." They're the most likely to focus on the rightness or logic of a solution, rather than spend a lot of time debating who's personally helped or hindered by it. The different styles often have different goals in mind. Even the number of objectives can differ. Directors prefer to focus on one specific goal. Ideally, it involves an action that's also efficient, productive, and cheap. Socializers, by contrast, may have many loosely defined objectives, and those may change over the course of time. If there's a consistent theme to the socializer's goal setting, it's getting the job done by being adaptable or by changing as much or as often as needed. Relators tend to favor multiple goals. If they must choose just one, it'd be the one that opens opportunities for themselves and others to work well together. So, for example, they might favor dividing the problem into parts and then assigning subgroups to handle each part. Quite to the contrary, thinkers, like directors, strongly prefer a single goal for the group. Thinkers especially like goals that put the greatest emphasis on accuracy or quality, such as deciding to produce the best item rather than one of lesser quality which might be made quicker or more cheaply. Thinkers also favor goals which promote the growth of something, size, profit, efficiency, customer satisfaction, or anything that can be reflected in an upward trend line. Working in a group, by definition, means involving others. But the four styles vary in why and how enthusiastically they embrace others. Generally, groups put together by directors will be smaller and have shorter meetings than those set up by people with other styles. Often, the director will want the group to make some key decisions on specific issues, then delegate the rest of the work to individuals or subcommittees. Socializers are more inclined to favor groups for group's sake. They like others to be involved in the give and take. Not everyone who's put on a committee by a socializer will have a logical role there, but in the socializer's mind, that person is further seasoning for the soup, if not necessarily a main ingredient. Relators also are innately attracted to groups. However, instead of using meetings for presentation of reports, they prefer to work toward consensus as they collect information from many sources. Likewise, thinkers involve others in groups to get information from a wide variety of sources. However, the thinkers are just less comfortable operating in groups. So they prefer to have much of the group work done behind the scenes by subgroups or individuals. The thinker especially likes to be the only one who knows how all the parts of the group's task puzzle fit together. Lastly, the four styles differ in their approach to group work because they tend to make decisions differently, as stated by my colleague Phil Hunsaker in his book, The Dynamic Decision Maker. In a meeting run by directors, decisions are more likely to be made unilaterally by the director, or he or she will call for a vote. Directors like voting because it's clean, quick, and decisive. It keeps debating to a minimum. Also, it's harder to argue that a vote is unfair, and closure is clearly attained. Next topic. A problem with voting, though the directors rarely see it as a problem, is that there are winners and losers. Socializers, being more people-oriented, try to work out compromises that reduce resentment and may fudge over differences. Socializers want to downplay group divisions, so they're not big on voting. Relators also prefer decisions by consensus. They'd like to see the vast majority of the group be on the bus, so actions tend to be worked and reworked until almost all are in agreement. Thinkers crave rational decisions. Optimally, the decision won't be made as much as it will be dictated by the facts and logic of the situation. Thinkers like to list pros and cons of issues, sometimes even weighing the options numerically to reach the correct decision. The process, they believe, will make obvious the best course of action. So all these differences make work groups trickier than they may seem at first glance. But such differences also can be an advantage. In modern business, it's particularly important to be alert to dissimilarities. Yesterday's management style was my way or the highway. Today, though, consensus building is king, and being a good communicator isn't an option, but an imperative. Formal research and my own field experience have shown that teams succeed or fail based on how well they deal with personal styles of all team members, including their adaptability, match the purpose and critical tasks of the team with the strengths of its members, and mesh with other groups within the organization. Such internal considerations are at the heart of most team problems and opportunities. We're now going to look at how groups can be more effective by taking advantage of behavioral style differences. But first, understand that there's two basic ways to set up a group to take advantage of personal styles. One way of doing it is by designing diverse teams, as Phil Hunsaker describes. These are groups comprised of employees from all four styles. Having such a mixed group is a double-edged sword. The downside is that the directors, for example, may be trying to bring debate to a close while relators or socializers are trying to whip up more discussion and heal any rifts. But on the positive side, when such group members appreciate their own and others' styles, they divide tasks up in such a way that everyone makes a maximum contribution. Each behavioral style can play a special role. Thinkers are terrific analysts and real sticklers for quality, so they can help a group to narrow its range of choices and ensure quality control. Relators, who are naturals at cooperation and collaboration, are great facilitators. Directors can give the group structure and momentum, and socializers can prevent conflict from becoming disabling. Each style has strengths that can complement the weaknesses of others. Having all four represented would make for an excellent team if they all practice the Platinum Rule. They would likely solve broad problems better and display more creativity than would a homogeneous group or a group that's stylistically diverse but not acting out of regard for others. When should a manager specifically try to create a diverse team? Research shows they're most effective when the situation is undefined, a goal has not been agreed upon or accepted, and the task is multidimensional, requiring a variety of perspectives and talents. For example, a bank's research may show that a large segment of the public dislikes it. Bank officials don't know if that disapproval stems from the bank's policies, the attitude of its employees, the nature of its ads, or even being confused with a similarly named bank. In such a case, having all four personality types on a task force would increase the chances of getting a full picture. No one has yet bought into a specific answer, so there's flexibility of thinking. Creating a diverse group probably would make a breakthrough in ideas and approaches much more likely. Another plus for a diverse team is that it more closely mirrors the external marketplace, including customer preferences. So if the task is, say, to develop a consumer product or service, the diverse team may better reflect commercial reality than would a more tightly focused group. As always, there's a trade-off. A diverse team may also present a greater potential for clashes. If a member doesn't understand or appreciate differing styles, that person may reject others' views, overtly or silently. And the whole process can suffer. The key, of course, is practicing the Platinum Rule ourselves and trying to get others to do likewise. The other approach to team formation is what Phil Hunsaker calls the targeted team. Many groups or teams probably do have a mixture of styles, but sometimes you can purposely create a team in which a majority of members, or maybe all, share a style. This gives the group a distinct identity and can be an immense advantage if the right style is matched with the right task. Many business committees or groups seek a single primary result. So in the short term, that's what they're trying to accomplish. Solve the problem, fill the position, market the product, cut the costs, whatever. That's a strong argument for creating a targeted team that can best get the job done. If, for example, the task is to find out why turbine number 3 keeps breaking down, you'd probably want analytical and results-oriented team members, such as thinkers and directors. For each style, there are kinds of tasks and situations for which they're best suited. The pivotal question to ask when you're designing a targeted team is, if you can only have one outcome or result, which is the most essential at this time? Is it ensuring bottom-line results, or promoting ideas, opportunities, and people, or coordinating with others, or even planning to meet specified expectations? Let's go over each one quickly to see which behavioral style best lends itself to getting that result. If ensuring bottom-line results is your primary consideration, here's where you can put your directors to work to control the situation. They're problem solvers who focus on practical actions and opportunities. Efficient, task-oriented, and quick, they're also entrepreneurial. So they'll emphasize cost versus benefit, profit versus loss, and risk versus reward. The team will make decisions rapidly and follow through forcefully, taking risks when necessary. The meetings will be brisk with a clear agenda set early on. The discussion will soon turn to issues and who's going to do what and by when. Much of the actual work will be done outside the larger group by individuals or subgroups. Subsequent meetings will be scheduled to bring results and findings back to the main group. Then, after a relatively brief discussion, any remaining differences will typically be resolved by the group leader or by a vote. The advantage of a targeted director group is that it's terrific if there's a need for speed, especially if the task is quite clear or easily subdivided. For example, you've got the first right of refusal on a potential site for a new factory. Within 30 days, you've got to measure that site against other possible locations, then make a thumbs-up, thumbs-down decision. A group dominated by directors would relish such a challenge. It'd assign its members to investigate the options without delay, then report back for a quick decision. Of course, the emphasis on speed of a directors-dominated team can also hobble the group if the problem doesn't lend itself to quick analysis. Say the property options turn out to be a lot more complicated than at first seemed. Maybe there are complex legal issues or environmental impact questions involved. Then the impatient directors might be tempted to conveniently ignore some information and make a force-fit decision. Usually, though, that won't happen if the nature of the problem is a good match with the nature of directors. When the key result you want is promoting ideas, opportunities, and people, then loose, informal socializers can be a great group to bring together. When you want to provide optimism, hope, and a climate of support, or just arrange for pure fun and celebration, the socializers will come through. Unlike the directors, they shun divisions of labor and use a lot of humor, especially if the discussion stalls. Meetings of socializer teams seldom follow a fixed agenda. If an agenda has been established, it's ignored, according to Phil Hunsaker. After starting a meeting with a specific issue or problem in mind, a socializer group tends to let whatever happens just happen. Usually, this means visiting many topics in quick succession. What that means is socializer groups often stand out from the others by producing a great number of wide-ranging ideas. The advantage of socializer-dominated groups is that they're well-suited for problems in which the interests of many different parties must be juggled or in which novel solutions are sought. For example, let's say your firm must come to grips with soaring healthcare costs, a subject with high potential for conflict. Being people-oriented and averse to confrontation, the socializers will be likely to find ways to diffuse tensions. And they're less likely than others to get hung up on minor details or past practices. So they may be able to forge compromises or see ways around obstacles that others are blind to. The disadvantage of a socializer-led group, as you might imagine, is they'll become too scattered. If each member goes off in a different direction, the team will break down and productivity will suffer. So short meetings are best with a gentle nudge about keeping to the key issues or tasks. Remember, they're best at producing ideas, not necessarily follow through. So, a director group is best for ensuring bottom line results. A socializer group is best for promoting ideas, opportunities, and people. Now, what if the key result you want is coordinating with others? With relators working toward that result, you've got the equivalent of the 1927 Yankees. What they most enjoy and do best is carrying out work in an organized, collaborative manner. So being in an all-relator group with the goal of coordinating with others can be akin to paradise. Both people-oriented and production-oriented, this team can exchange a lot of ideas, then pool them to come up with group solutions. Relators welcome conflicting information and differing viewpoints. They keep focused on their objectives, with the main group doing most of the analysis themselves rather than delegating it. A unique characteristic of a relator group, according to Dr. Hunsaker, is its tendency to comment on the group's own process while it's happening. For example, someone might say, "Ed, you've been kind of quiet on this issue. What are your thoughts?" Or they might say, "Let's think for a moment about how we might go ahead from here." Other groups may do postmortems, but only relators tend to monitor the ongoing progress, and that helps them stay on track. The open, exploratory nature of a relator team is great for creative problem solving. These groups seem to escape much of the infighting which often plagues other teams, so they have a higher potential for cooperation and synergy. This team, then, is effective for resolving conflicts and promoting cooperation while finding ways to build upon each other's ideas. Here's an example. Your firm is in an older section of town with limited parking. Your outside salespeople must park on the street when they bring in their sales contracts. The salespeople either end up getting tickets or waste a lot of time running back and forth to feed the meters. Either way, it's becoming a morale problem. Yet the company can't afford to greatly increase its parking budget. That might be a perfect assignment for a team of relators. They'd be sensitive to the morale factor while not forgetting the bottom line consideration. They wouldn't be bound by old solutions and would be willing to look at everything from operating shuttle buses to staggering work hours to providing bonuses for carpools or even hiring the homeless to feed the parking meters. The relators would enjoy being actively involved in a company-wide decision that affected individual employees in a positive way. Are there any disadvantages to such a team? While they're good at working with people and creating ideas, relators sometimes have trouble getting closure. Periodic progress and time checks can help them from straying too far afield. Now, what if the key result you're looking for is planning to meet specified expectations? Here's where a thinkers-led team is best. Thinkers are natural planners, and so they're often best for team issues such as these. Are certain types of business ventures worth doing or continuing? Should we change our priorities or the ways we do things? Would different approaches or actions be more effective? A thinker group will probably have a show-and-tell quality, with lots of information presented in a predictable way, punctuated by serious questions. The meetings will be more formally structured and may last a long time. But thinkers won't lurch or thrash about. Instead, they'll persist with an analysis until they pretty much know what they should do and how and when and usually why. Seldom do thinkers vote. Instead, support just coalesces behind what's seen as the most logical, rational choice, the one with the best and most convincing support on key criteria. The advantage of such a group is that thinkers are thorough, accurate, and detail-oriented. Let's say, for instance, you're deciding whether to add another production line at your bottling plant. A thinker team might be a natural match. They would price out all the equipment, calculate the labor costs, and compare the cost per unit produced with the likely market price. They would also project the change in your market share. In short, they'd chart all the ideas, pros and cons, backing them up with facts and figures. A significant downside is that the analysis could potentially degenerate into debates over smaller and smaller details until the big picture is lost. Thinkers tend to form their opinions slowly, but then hang on to them stubbornly. So there's a potential for gridlock, but a wise facilitator can help move the process along. Above all, when putting together a team of any sort, always be clear about what it is you want to accomplish. The personal styles of the people you select will have a major impact on how the group will likely operate and what it will achieve. In the next segment of this program, we'll bring the focus back to you and how you can use the Platinum Rule to excel as a leader in your work environment.